58. Thursday, sunny and 75. Right now, humidity is still a tad high at 74%. 73 degrees in both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am excited to be starting part one of today's morning show with Doug Instinus, the managing and artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild, and more to the point, also the director of the current production at the Guild, which is a lovely, wonderful, fun show called First Date. And it opens this coming weekend. It runs this weekend and the next weekend. And it's been my pleasure to be the music director for the summer show for the first time in quite a few years. And Doug has been the stage director and handling so many different details to try to bring this show to fruition. And we're going to be talking about it, playing a few excerpts from it. And the next few minutes should be fun. Doug Instinus, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning.
Glad you have peeled yourself out of bed. This is sometimes called Hell Week or Tech Week, depending on how you look at it. But actually, it's been a relatively comfortable final week of rehearsals. And we were just saying before we went on the air, the fact that this is a relatively short show in terms of start to finish, that makes a difference for everybody in terms of just kind of how much work it is.
Everybody gets to go to bed early instead of staying up into the wee hours. So it's only an hour and a half with no intermission, so we kind of zip through it.
Right. So tell our listeners a little bit about how this and why this show got chosen to be the summer show at the Theater Guild.
We have a play reading committee, and each year, there's about eight of us that read a lot of plays, and somebody brought this up, and I had never heard of First Date before. And we got the script and saw a few of the clips, and I said, wow, this is really charming. It's a little edgy for the Theater Guild. It's not Forever Plaid or Always Patsy Cline. You know, the summer is a weird time for us because we often come off of a big musical at the end of the year, and it has to rehearse at the same time. So finding that summer show, and it's last few years it's been a musical, is often difficult. And this is a small cast show. It's, you know, very different than Cabaret when we closed. Very modern, a younger cast. And we said, wow, this could be fun. And it's very different from some of the musicals we've done in the past. And being a small show that takes place in a bar, it lends itself to live music, which we don't often have at the Theater Guild. Many times we have recorded music. So Doug Klum, a local musician in town and former educator, he's put together a band for us. And so we go to this hip happening bar. So I'm relying on young people for advice and counsel on this. We have a lot of young people who are acting as dramaturg on this. What's a cool bar look like, and what's hip clothes look like, and you know, what would they be wearing, and how are their hairstyles? Because, you know, I'm a little past my hip stage, and so
as am I.
So it's been fun. It's been a joy to work on, and we all thought it'd be something different than the normal musical reviews that we've done sometimes in the past, and so we're excited to bring it.
I have to say that one of the most exciting moments for me was at the first read-through, and part of what made it really fun, too, was for whatever reason that read-through occurred in the lobby of the Theater Guild, and these long tables were kind of set up in a big square, and here are these seven young people who comprise the cast, and of course you and I had heard them in the audition, so it's not like it should have been any sort of big surprise, and yet I was just blown away by how wonderfully cast all of these people were. I guess part of it was I hadn't read through the whole script. I only knew the songs. I knew how they would do singing them. But in terms of all the dialogue and bringing these different characters alive, that was a really exciting moment for me to just hear how great this cast of seven turned out to be.
And relieved. Hey, we cast it well. All right.
Absolutely.
Good for us.
So, First Date does pretty much serve up the central story of the musical, First Date, and yet it's about more than just this young man and this young woman on their first date, because we have a cast of seven, and I think the way it's been put together is pretty ingenious. So explain what happens and how we see all of these different people through the course of this evening.
One of the interesting things is, it is on the first date, but it's really about relationships and trusting and friendship and what people want out of life and preconceived notions that we have about men and women and their roles. So, somebody asked me once, can you relate to this? Well, I've never really had a blind date like that, and I've been married over 30 years, so it's hard for me to remember dating. But there's so much in this play that talks about relationships and friendships and family relationships and what people want out of life that it's just more than that. So we have a young man, Aaron, who recently has his fiance left him on their wedding day. Is trying to get back into the dating game. And we have Casey, who is described as a serial dater, who has never always seems to find something wrong with the people that she's going out with. And she's very closed and very guarded as far as opening up to people. So they are set up by Casey's sister, whose husband works with Aaron and loves him. So they go to a blind date. And they meet, and they're opposites. And, he's kind of conservative, and he's got a suit and tie, and she's very edgy, hip and happening, and a photographer type. And through their conversations, they have inner monologues. And this is where the fun happens, where other people, it's kind of like, angel and devil on your shoulder that appear and they talk in your ear. So we have these little fantasy moments where they you hear inner monologues. And then Lauren's sister, Lauren, Casey's sister, and Gabe, who is Aaron's best friend, are giving them dating advice. And it's not very good advice.
Right, for sure.
They're always in their ear, say this, do that. And the ex-girlfriend, appears, and ex-boyfriends appear through these fantasy sequences. And, they say the things that you think about. First date, it starts off with first impressions, where they immediately make judgments about the way they look and the way they act and who the type of person they are. And I can just tell by looking at him that he's, stuffy and conservative, and it's a very fun thing about making judgments about people. And then they decide, well, it's going okay. Maybe they'll have dinner. And they get into some funny conversations. They get into some life conversations, some serious things. They get to know each other. And at first glance, she is not attracted to him. She likes bad boys. And she tells him that. Well, then he gets offended because, I've been a bad boy. Well, he hasn't really been a bad boy. But, as they open up, they really start to understand each other and care about each other. And at the end, are we going to take a risk? This is different from what I've experienced in the past, but what I've experienced in the past hasn't always worked. So maybe just maybe we'll take a risk and we'll go out there and I've talked to a couple friends and people that are widowed or going through that now at a later stage, and it's hard. Relationships, meeting people, talking to them, getting to know them, going out there, being vulnerable. So this is what the play talks about. In the midst of all that is some naughty language and some swear words and some silliness and some fun and things that people think in their own mind, but they would never, ever say in public. You know, you think those things, but you don't say them. Well, in this play, sometimes they say them. So we're having a great time. It's just a story about two people getting to know each other and taking a risk and opposites attract and learning what's important in life. So
we're speaking with Doug Instanis, who is the director of the Racine Theater Guild's production of the musical First Date. We'll sample a couple of songs from it in just a moment. Just for a moment, let's talk about the matter of language and the fact that it is, to put it mildly, salty. I mean, particularly in comparison to what is usually seen on the stage of the Theater Guild. How much do you think about that? And then when it comes to deciding that we're going to do this show, swear words and all, then what do we do about that? I mean, do we put up signs? I mean, how do you to what extent is it important for people to walk in the door understanding that this is part of what the evening's going to be?
I think it's really important because I think people have expectations. And if you see come to the Theater Guild and you're used to seeing Annie and Best Christmas Pageant Ever and Little Mermaid, and then you get a play that has more modern adult language, it catches you off guard. And what I talk about is it takes you out of the moment, which means you pay more attention to the swear word than you do the theme behind it,
right,
or what the reason behind it. So that's what concerns me about some of the language or the topics. It's that people get lost in that and they missed the point. You know, why did they swear? What did it mean? What was the purpose behind it? So if we warn people about that, then they go in there with the understanding of that. And in this play, you know, when a lot of times we change things because there's just a little bit of language here or it's not really needed. You know, somebody was just, you know, writing it, and it's, you can get the point across. This is very modern, and this is the way people talk. This is the way young people talk now, and it's just very casual for people to swear or use vulgarity, and it's just what they do. Now, in this play, it's all used for comedy, which is different, too, when people shouldn't be offended because it's not in my mind, it's not offensive because it's used in comedic ways, and it's never to degrade or to belittle or to humiliate. It's just funny,
and it also, at least almost all the time, seems to spring out of the moment and springs out of who these characters are.
Right.
And as someone who is even less a fan of swearing than you are, I mean, I don't ever swear. I really, it's not something I particularly enjoy encountering, but. I appreciate and respect the fact that it's here, in a sense, for the sense of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would otherwise not ring true.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it. And we were talking also before we went on the air about how most of the time the musicals at the Theater Guild have to be done with a pre-recorded, professionally done accompaniment track. And in this case, it's a live band on the stage, and one has a sense that that really creates a special electricity, and certainly for the cast, they seem to be really enjoying the experience of being able to do this show with a live band right with them on the stage.
Yeah, it gives, again, a more modern feel to it, a more hip happening. We're in this classy, upscale bar, and we've got a band that's playing along with them, and I think they're enjoying it a lot.
Yeah. So I thought it would be fun to listen to at least a couple of the songs from the show. I want to mention that one of the most interesting songs is not part of the original Broadway cast recording, so we can't play it. But I think it's an interesting song to mention because it kind of touches on the contemporary feel of this show. And it's a song called The World Wide Web. Explain to our listeners why right in the middle of this song, of this show, is a song about the World Wide Web and Facebook and Twitter and so on.
Yeah, again, this is a modern show about how people date now. People do a lot of online dating and profiling, and so they meet on this blind date, except for Aaron has information about Casey that he shouldn't have. How did you know this? Did you Google me? And then he goes, yeah, I did. And, well, then I'm going to Google you. And then they get into this thing about trying to search each other and find out information. And so through that, we get Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all of those things. They pop up and they have comments about, you know, was one of the Aaron, you know, played the lead in a musical, and there's a picture of them on the web, and she did this, and so they're finding dirt on each other. So that's what's happening now, right? People,
right.
You know, don't post stuff on Facebook that you don't want people to find 20 years from now.
Right. The refrain of this really high energy song is, "The World Wide Web is forever."
Right.
So be careful what you put out there. So, well, we do have plenty of other songs from the show that we can sample. So why don't you pick one, and we'll hear a little bit of it.
Oh, my. What ones can you play on the air without bleeping? What about the end where, you know, about taking a risk and...
Okay.
Is that on there?
Something That Will Last.
Something That Will Last.
So
yeah.
This is a song sung by the two main characters of Aaron and Casey, who are, in a sense, weighing that whole matter of the risk you take when you are kind of maybe taking the plunge and going forward with a relationship. So we'll hear a little bit of this song, the final song, actually, of the musical First Date.
I am standing at the start of something that is new. I can't keep building walls despite what I've been through. If I may have found the someone, the one I should be looking for, I'd be a jerk to run away, so I'll hold my breath and stay.
There's a person by my side, she's not who I had planned, yet I feel the sudden urge to reach out and take her hand. And I yearn for letting go of all the baggage in my past. If I don't try, I'll never know just how far this thing might go. We can make it to tomorrow, or just end it all right here.
We could fall flat on our faces, or fall more in love each year.
With so little to be sure of,
possibilities are vast. Maybe one perfect moment, or maybe this is something that will last.
Well, this is my place.
Ah, yes, so it is. Nice building. Excellent structural engineering. Quit stalling and tap that shit already! Columns and bricks.
Thank you. I designed it all myself. Okay.
So a little bit of a taste of this song called Something That Will Last from the musical First Date. It kind of brings to mind the fact that having a real good pair of protagonists is especially important on this date, on this show, because you want those two to be believable and have, in a sense, an uneasy chemistry with one another.
Yeah, you have to find something about them that you like, and you're rooting for them, right? Opposites attract, I think. And I think, again, good plays are universal, and we see things in Aaron that we see in ourselves. He's shy, you know, maybe he's a little bit more conservative than he should be, and he's been hurt in past relationships, and he's, you know, struggling to figure out where to go. And Casey's been hurt in a different way, but she's a little bit more rebellious and a little bit more closed and guarded. And we know these people, and we root for them. You know, we root for them to get together. And one of the questions I keep asking the cast is, 6 months from now, are they going to be together? And we hope so, right? That's what we want, we want them to have it all worked out.
Right. In addition to those two central characters of Aaron and Casey, we have then the others in the cast who really provide a lot of texture, these three guys and two women, and they are playing, at least in for the most part, multiple, I guess everybody, mm-hmm. all five of them play multiple roles, and so they all get a chance to really shine. One of the characters we see the most in the background is sort of the head waiter slash bartender in this bar. And tell our listeners about the big song that he finally gets to sing towards the end of the show.
Well, he's got big dreams to be on Broadway and to be a singer. And he works in a restaurant as a waiter. And so he periodically will just sing for the patrons. And they're kind of captive audience. They have to sit there and watch him. And he's, you know, in some ways, he's the matchmaker in the show. He, you know, sits him at the table. They're, both of them meet him to come into the bar. They sit down, and he sings this song in a very awkward moment when the two of them are fighting. He sings a song about love, and I'm doing it for you, table three. And they're going, oh, no. And he puts them on the spot. And it's fun. It's awkward. It's sweet. And Kyle is just doing a great job as the Broadway waiter.
So here's some of the big song he does, his own little production number, a song called I'd Order Love. I'd Order Love.
I've made my career as a waiter, and my job, well, it never gets old. I've seen romances bloom, wild affairs meet their doom. Every night, some new sight to behold. Yet I find, as I wait on my tables and serve them their baskets of bread, I can't help but think, as they pick out a drink, of what I would order instead. I'd order love, delicious, well-seasoned and rare. I'd order love, a big enough portion to share. Bring me all of the heartache, a small side of woe, that flavor of longing that I long to know. I don't need a menu, just someone to care for my heart. Yes, I'd order love, there's no I'd order love that's spicy and steaming and hot. Oh, I'd order love so juicy it just hits the spot. Put up on a pow pow. A grave night's full of passion, all drizzled with lust. Breakfast in bed is an absolute must. Then bring on the marriage, but don't top it off with divorce. Yes, I'd order love. It's the very best second course.
Really fun song from this show, First Date. I'd Order Love, sung by the waiter. And it's a really, really, really fun moment. Another really interesting device that is used from time to time through the show is a series of songs that are called the Bailout. Bailout song number one, bailout song number two, and number three. Explain to our listeners, because some of them might not even be acquainted with the concept of having a bailout when you're on a date.
So Reggie is Casey's best friend. So what best friends do when you're on a blind date is they call you and give you an excuse to leave. If it's going poorly, you can say, oh, you're going to play the song, but, you know, your dog's ate chocolate or your mom's sick or something like that, that you got to go. There's an emergency. And so throughout the show, Reggie keeps calling Casey to bail her out, and she doesn't pick up. And
because things are going okay.
Yeah, and he's mad about that because that's not what you do. You're ignoring me, and Reggie doesn't get ignored. And he's a great character. He's, everybody should have a best friend called Reggie.
Right. And for sure you should have someone as talented as Steven to be him. So here is just one of these short little bailout songs that we hear through the course of the musical First Date.
Hey, it's Casey. Blah, 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 blah.
This is your bailout, sweetie, your bailout. Honey, I'm calling to bail you out. And I'm getting your voicemail once again. What's the deal? I mean, really? Call me back because I'm bored. And I'm feeling toasted, ignored.
Later, slut.
It's just one of those things that just like kind of punctuates the evening. They're really, really fun. And, of course, we've used the word fun quite a lot, but there are lots of deeply, deeply poignant moments in this show as well.
Right. There's a scene where they talk about Aaron's mother who passed away. And, you know, Casey just starts making jokes about family, and you got an overprotective mom, and does she miss her little boy? And finally he says, no, my mom passed away. And it's like, oh, my. And... you know, find out about, you know, everybody's got issues in their life, you know, and you think, well, you're come from a privileged background and you have this in your life and you have that in your life and you have a good job and I have it worse. Well, maybe not. You know, when you get to know people, everybody has baggage. Everybody has pain in their life that they may or may not want to share.
Right.
And it affects how they grow up. And getting to know them, you start learning that you have more things in common than maybe you initially thought. And this, the song between the two of them, the mom and Aaron, is wonderful.
Let's hear just a little bit of it. And the song is called The Things I Never Said. So it's really a song about the things that sometimes are important to say, but that for whatever reason get left unsaid. One more song from the musical First Date.
Easy to express what I feel inside, but that shouldn't come as a surprise to you. Haven't been the perfect mom, but please know that I tried. I did the best I could, and that's the best that I could do.
Face my fears and fight back years of uncried tears and tell you all the things I never said.
That's a truly fantastic song.
Yeah.
It really is, lyrically and musically and so on. And it kind of points to something that drives me crazy about a show like The Bachelor, which I just hate, I hate that show, because when they go on these supposed dates, they never talk about each other. Uh-huh. It's always about and after this I thought we'd go on a boat ride, and oh, and after this I think we're gonna, and all they talk about is the date itself, and they don't do any of that exploration of, you know, who this other person really is and what's part of their life and their history. And of course that's what we see play out on the stage of the Theater Guild through the course of this first date between these two people brave enough to try to get to know each other. So it is about to open, and I think you're feeling very optimistic about how it's all, or very grateful about how it's all come together.
Yeah, we've had a great time putting it together, and the cast is getting along well. We just added the band last night and got a great crew, and it's fun. And it's, you know, it's a little scary with comedy sometimes, to be honest with you. When you're doing a comedy for, you know, 6-7 weeks, you find it really funny the first couple days. It's like, oh my goodness, I hope this is funny, because you've heard the jokes over and over and over again, and you just go, oh, we really need an audience because I need to be reminded. Now, and this has not been the case for me on this show. This I enjoy watching, and it's I know the joke's coming, and it's still funny to me.
Yeah.
And the cast has really, really come together and worked as a team. You know, not just, you know, Casey and Aaron, but all of the extra weird and crazy people that come in on the show. It's fun. And so, and of course, at the Theater Guild, you're only 10 rows away from the actors. So you're very close and very intimate. So it feels like you're in the bar and you're part of it. I'm excited to see what people think about it.
So it opens this weekend, this Friday night, and runs this weekend and the next. And if people are interested in getting tickets,
you can call the box office at 262-633-4218, or you can order tickets online or stop by the theater from noon to 6, Monday through Friday, our theater on Northwestern Avenue. So come and join and have just a really good time.
Very good. Doug Instanis, the stage director for the musical First Date, opening this Friday night at the Racine Theater Guild. Thank you, Doug. Best wishes to you and the cast and crew of First Date. And here is part two of today's program at 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. And for the next few minutes, we're going to be delving into the fascinating and long history of one of the most powerful shows on network television, Grey's Anatomy. A really illuminating book has been written about the show called How to Save a Life, The Inside Story of Grey's Anatomy. It's written by Lynette Rice, who is an editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly, has covered many facets of the entertainment industry for a quarter of a century, and has written very powerfully about Grey's Anatomy over the years. And this book is published by St. Martin's Press. And Lynette Rice, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's my pleasure. Great to be here.
I really have enjoyed this book. And I want to also add, if this isn't too offensive to anybody listening, I'm actually not a huge diehard fan of Grey's Anatomy. And the reason I even mention my own kind of relationship with the show is that nevertheless, I found your book absolutely fascinating. So I don't think you have to be a fervent fan of Grey's Anatomy to really enjoy this book. That being said, I suspect that you have written it mostly with fans of the show in mind. Or did you have a wider purpose?
I thank you for that. That's such a great endorsement, too, coming from somebody who didn't really watch the show. It was a tough nut to crack for me because when I started it, it was hard to figure out how am I going to wrap up at that time when I started. It was still just started up on its 16th season. How do you cover everything that happened in 16 seasons? You can't. So I just focus on the stuff that, as a reporter, always interested me, and that's, of course, the humble beginnings of the show, the crazy departures on the show, and the moments in time that generated so much heat, so much drama that had all of us reporters scurrying to get every last scoop out of that show.
Right. And as a matter of fact, that's, you know, kind of one of the recurring themes is how to cover a phenomenon like this. Can you explain the intriguing title to the book, How to Save a Life?
One of the great things about Grey's Anatomy is that it was part of this growing movement for television shows to use pop music to help set the narrative on the show. And one of the songs that they used was a song by The Fray called How to Save a Life. And I go back and I talk to a couple of musical artists about their songs that really became huge international hits thanks to Grey's Anatomy. And I talked to, you know, The Fray about how they came up with the song How to Save a Life. And it was actually a very poignant story. It was that they worked in a rehab camp, and they met a young addict who was really battling with a drug addiction. And his happy ending never really came. He was on and off the drug. And The Fray, just they kind of had this epiphany, like, the sign at pools where it says, like, what to do if somebody drowned, and that inspired the song. So anyway, that became an anthem on that show, How to Save a Life. It was used multiple times in episodes. And so when you hear it now, you just think of Grey's Anatomy, which is such a testament to the power of that show.
Mm. You've already made brief mention of the fact that this show began rather unremarkably, in a sense, under circumstances in which probably nobody, even those who most believed in the show, would have predicted what a runaway hit it would ultimately become. Explain to our listeners just how unremarkable the beginnings were, or kind of the unlikely circumstances under which this show began.
So this was developed right around the time of Lost and Desperate Housewives, two huge ABC shows that had just launched. They were doing really well. And then there was this drama, this medical drama, that was bought by an unknown writer by the name of Shonda Rhimes. They were able to shoot six episodes without pressure to get them on the air like the next few weeks. So they got them all in the can, you know, in relative silence. They were off in the valley of Los Angeles doing that. One thing that made even people on the cast, the crew, excuse me, feel like ABC didn't care about the show was the fact that Grey's Anatomy had a Dr. Shepard. Just like there was a Dr. Shepard on Lost, there was nobody in the executive suites that even like considered the fact that, okay, my God, we're going to have two Dr. Shepherds on our network. The Dr. Shepard on Lost, by the way, was played by Matthew Fox. He was the lead in Lost. And, of course, Patrick Dempsey played Dr. Shepard on Grey's, but they stayed with it. So as soon as this show aired, it immediately exploded, and they immediately picked up more episodes, and that just ran from there. It was the epitome of overnight success for that show.
I have a feeling a lot of people will snap up this book to read about the cast, but I must confess that what I found every bit as interesting, in some cases even more interesting, is some of the people whom we never see on camera who play pivotal roles. And one of them, with whom I'm so intrigued, is network executive Steve McPherson, who was described by a couple of different people in your book as, in a sense, an exceptionally meddlesome, hands-on studio executive. I mean, really interfering in a lot of different things and trying to kind of micromanage a lot of aspects. And he's probably not unique, and we hear so many horror stories about the guy from the network who inserts himself into the proceedings. I appreciate that we hear from him directly as well as those that had to work with him. What was your takeaway about Steve McPherson and his contributions to the early days of Grey's Anatomy?
Covering network presidents has been one of the fun aspects of my job over, you know, 20 years, 25 years of covering television, because everyone has their own drama associated with them, and then they have their own legacies to deal with. Steve McPherson did not have a positive legacy at ABC. He ultimately left amid allegations of harassment, sexual harassment with women at the network. And so, I mean, he didn't leave on good terms. And those allegations kind of swirled, too, when he was overseeing Grey's Anatomy. There are also feelings that he never liked the show. And you'll hear the producers say this. You'll hear Ellen Pompeo say it today. He never really liked the show. And there's always those kind of comments, too, about, you know, network presidents. I mean, like armchair quarterbacking, like, yeah, he didn't like it. But the fact is, maybe he didn't like aspects of it, but he still has to green light this show at the end of the day. And he did pick up the show despite having some reservations about, you know, certain scenes in the pilot. Because, you know, they shoot a pilot, and then you make the decision from there, do we go ahead and make it to a series? Which he made that decision. So it rests on him. So it seems a little unfair, and I agree with him about that, to say that I did, you know, to look back at him and say he was mean to the show, he didn't like it, because he still picked it up.
For sure. Yeah, it's a complicated story, and we realize that that sometimes network executives can be portrayed in rather cartoonish fashion as people that mostly meddle and don't let the creative folks do their work and so on. And I like that we hear more about Steve McPherson than just that. Another person off camera that I think is so interesting is costume designer Mimi Melgard. And she describes some of what was important to her and to Chandra and to Peter Horton, the director of the pilot, in terms of what these people should look like, down to details like the kind of scrubs they should wear. I found this fascinating. Can you just tell our listeners a little about this?
Well, you know, scrubs are not that sexy unless, of course, you know, somebody like Patrick Dempsey is wearing them. And then you see this stuff. You know how even today would be, you know, like a 7-Eleven and a doctor comes in his scrubs. You know, it's like, okay, he's showing off he's a doctor. But, you know, they just kind of hang. They're meant to be comfortable. They're meant not to necessarily be in the way of your daily work. But they still had to make them sexy because, you know, this is supposed to be a sexy show. So they worked with scrubs. And, you know, they definitely tried to take them in so they would still show off the figure of their young actors while still looking, making them look like doctors. You know, ultimately, Mimi's goal was to never have the clothes overpower the characters, overpower the show, a rule that wasn't, you know, followed like on Shonda's subsequent show, Scandal. In fact, the clothes were an integral part of that show. They didn't want that to be here a grace. The attention had to be on the actors. So she tried not to make sure that the clothes, you know, spoke volumes, for the exception of one very important dress, and that was Katherine Heigl's dress when she went to a formal dance with her beloved Denny early on in the show. I mean, that dress itself, this pink ball gown, has a life of its own.
Mm. And she also says that one of the reasons to kind of keep the show, the clothing subtle, is that if the show went into syndication, which she believed it ultimately would, the clothes would look a little more timeless, which of course makes a lot of sense. Well, let's talk about this amazing cast. And I think at one point it's T.R. Knight who describes them as a ragtag team of weirdos with a kind of unexplainable chemistry. And, of course, I think he's speaking about the cast fairly early on in the show. Tell us more about that unexplainable chemistry that was present in this ensemble.
Well, I think it all helped that they were all relative unknowns cast together. I mean, Patrick Dempsey was the only one who had a career that, you know, people recognized. I mean, they'd all been working, but they weren't household names. And they were all close in age. And so they were all in it together. And the great thing, especially about the very beginning, they worked in silence. They weren't on the air yet, so they could bond. They had a chance to bond, which was neat. So early on, they were treated like equals. They felt like equals. And so they were able to kind of party like equals, too. There's a old saying in television that, you know, and it's from the actor's point of view, the first season, I work for you. The second season, we work together. The third season, you work for me. And in many respects, several of the actors kind of operated that way. You know, they were in it together for a while, but then their lives changed. The popularity of the show changed. Their individual personalities, their Q rating, so to speak, changed. And so it became a very different culture.
Mm. Shonda Rhimes is, of course, amazing. And you describe her, I think, in one of your introductions as brilliant. I mean, unmistakably brilliant, but an untested showrunner. And, of course, that's another role that she has with the show. And I find that to be an intriguing combination of someone who is brilliantly talented and yet almost brand new in the TV business and taking on responsibilities she'd never taken on before. Describe just how well she managed to do that.
Well, what typically happens in television, if there's an untested person, they bring in other executive producers who have more experience to surround that untested showrunner. In this case, it was men, Peter Horton, who was an executive producer slash director. He's the actor from 30-something who went behind the scenes. And another very tested showrunner by the name of Jim Perriott. They were there to help keep the train on the tracks, but it still was Shonda's show. She took it over. And she just was very intuitive about what the audiences wanted from the show. One of my favorite quotes in the whole book was from a writer on the show, a longtime writer on the show. His name is Tony Phelan. And he was talking about how what typically happens in a scene between Meredith and McDreamy is the camera will go back and forth if they're having a deep argument. But in this one particular scene, the camera stayed focused on McDreamy, and Tony was like, Shonda, we need to cut back to Meredith. And Shonda said, no, I want him talking right to the camera because I want that woman in Iowa to feel like he is talking to her. McDreamy is her man, her husband, her love of her life. And that was such a genius idea because that's why so many women fell in love with this man. That's why so many people even today can't even imagine that Patrick became difficult to work with on the show toward the end because he's perfect in every way. And if the strength of his acting was he made people believe that he's this way 24/7. He's our dream man 24/7.
Well, and of course, it sounds like he was incredibly kind and gracious for quite a number of years, but after a while that starts to wear away and he does indeed become difficult. And of course, one of the hallmarks of the story of Grey's Anatomy, and it's told very well in your book, is of how things become difficult for certain actors who ultimately have to depart, are killed off or whatever, and all of those stories are here. I think it's important for us to talk about the fans. And of course, the fan base of Grey's Anatomy has been ferociously passionate right from the start, in part because of kind of the way things were set up, giving them forums to express their every opinion about the show. Tell us more about this, and if television had ever seen anything like it or has seen anything since, like the fan base of Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, it started with blogging. Shonda made all her writers blog about episodes. So that created one of the first platforms for fans to weigh in. And then, of course, there's the advent of social media, which has completely changed network television. You know, people can get very involved in a show to the point that fans believe that they should be able to decide how a show should behave, how stories should play out. And you know, the writers, to their strength, you know, first with Shonda and then with Krista Vernoff, who now is running the show, who's basically, you know, Shonda's mini-me, you can't let the fans decide because fans will keep people together far longer than they need to be. You know, a story needs conflict to continue to live, to continue to be interesting to us. If everyone's happy all the time, it would get bloody boring quick.
Lynette Rice, and in this interview from 2021, she discusses her book, How to Save a Life, the Inside Story of Grey's Anatomy. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We hope you can join us tomorrow when Kaylin Palomares joins us along with Dr. Jim Shute, who is a research director at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute and also a farmer who engages in regenerative farming practices. We'll find out what all of that is about. And on Friday, at least tentatively, best-selling author James Patterson talking about his new book, Tiger, Tiger, which is a biography of the great golfer Tiger Woods. Don't forget that you can also subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast to hear a different morning show 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. have a very pleasant weather forecast for the next week or so. Today we will have mostly sunny skies, and we're headed for a high of 78 degrees. Clear overnight with a low of 58 degrees. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 75. Sunny on Friday and a high of 79. Warming into the low 80s for a high, again with persistently sunny skies all through the weekend and into early next week. The first rain in our forecast is on Tuesday. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.